Welcome everybody to a program that is organized by Bhikkhu Halim, Yom Yedva Shom Emuna, on a very interesting and important topic. But before I get into these details, and a lot of details we're going to be covering by four of our speakers, a word from one of our major sponsors, Audrey Siegel, whose idea it was to do this program. So I give her the floor, then we will get into the program.
Thanks. It's just a short PSA, public service announcement. Four quick things. One, I want to just say how appreciative, as always, I am personally and the organization is to Mass Remnant for organizing all of these programs. At Beaker Fulham of Greater Washington, our goal is not just to help people when they're sick, but to keep them on the healthy and giving side. So these programs are extremely important. And I just mentioned to Max, so my point number two that I wanted to share with you is we don't always get feedback, you know, after these programs. We don't know the impact they've had on people's lives. But I was fortunate enough to share a meal with somebody a few weeks ago who afterwards pulled me aside to let me know how a previous program that Max had helped organize on overeating and how to change eating patterns and adjust one's life had actually transformed this person's life. She told me that after that program, she got in touch with one of the speakers. She got involved in the program that person was involved in. And for the first time in her life, after years of struggle, she transformed and has consistently been able to maintain that transformation. And she was pretty emotional, and so was I. And I just want to, again, thank Max for his vision in creating these programs and just to have that feedback that they are actually life-altering and extremely important, as I expect this one today will be as well. Number three is I wanted, because I have you all together, it's a great opportunity for me to just let you all know and for you to share with others, if you don't already, that Beaker Fulham of Greater Washington partnered with Holy Cross Hospital and was able to open up the Beaker Fulham room in the hospital, and it's on the second floor. Very exciting. Many, many different people helped bring that dream to reality. And it's really been already quite useful. It's on the second floor inside the cafeteria. And there's a sign on the door. If you go into the cafeteria, you look to your right, you will see that sign. And no one here should ever need it. But just in case, or if you know of someone who does, there's a code on the door, and people can access it just anytime, 24/7. That was number three. And lastly, next Sunday, hopefully by now, I haven't annoyed everybody too much with all of my emails. If I haven't, let me know, and I'll send more. So next Sunday is our biggest fundraiser. We have a couple of big fundraisers over the course of the year, but this is the biggest one. We rely on it. And it's not just a fundraiser. It's an awareness builder. We get a huge bump in volunteers every year after this event, and we desperately need that. We really run on volunteer power, and I cannot even begin to tell you how many volunteers are working today while we speak, delivering food to Bethesda, to Children's National, taking people places. It's just a constant thing. And I would be remiss if I didn't also mention that one of our star, we have four star volunteers, and one of them is Rabbi Barry Greengart. I'm looking at his wife, Debbie, because I know that she's really a partner, and he's emphasized that to me as well. So Rabbi Greengart, member of Shomer Emuna. We also have Sylvia Goldberg, who's a member of the Kent Mill Synagogue, and Nancy Weissman and Eve Farber, both of whom live in Bethesda, and are extremely important volunteers for us, as so much of our work is connected to the National Institutes of Health and Suburban Hospital. I just wanted to let everybody know, it's not too late to register, but it will be soon. We are going to close registration tonight, because the caterer does need to know the numbers. So if you have not registered, please think of doing so. If you cannot attend, please think of supporting the event. You can do so with an ad. You can do so with a contribution. If you go to our website, there's this beautiful design, thank you, Adina Moses, right on the website that you can click on, and that will take you to the registration page. And don't worry, it won't commit you right away. You can read through everything before you actually enter your credit card information. So thank you very much. We really do rely on it. It helps keep us going all year long. Thanks, Max, and thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming. So Rishuth Rabbi Rosenbaum, talk a little bit about this program. Over the past several years, Bhikkhu Halim of Greater Washington and Young Israel have organized programs on a wide range of health education, topics of interest and value. They are co-sponsored by other synagogues, Camp Mill Synagogue, Sivas Preacher Center, Chabad Sivas Strength, Oral Torah, and Southeast Hebrew Congregation. As science unravels some of the mysteries of our genetic makeup, we have the opportunity to learn about our own genetic profile and make informed decisions. It's been almost 25 years since certain genetic mutations were identified that occur much more frequently among Ashkenazi Jews than other population groups. These mutations are associated with increased risk of breast, ovarian, and prostate cancers. Our program will address a number of questions. How do you find out if you are carrying such mutations? Do you have a responsibility to find out? What would lead you to want to find out? What do you do if you are a carrier of such mutations? And if you're not a carrier but know someone who is, how can you help? Different aspects of these questions will be tackled by our first three speakers, Rabbi Rosenbaum, Eileen France, and Elizabeth Salk. After we address these questions, our last speaker, Judy Rosenthal, will discuss what happens if surgery is required from the perspective of a cancer survivor. Our first speaker, Rabbi Rosenbaum, will address some of the halachic and hashkafic issues that arise in responding to this mutation called BRCA, BRCA 1 and 2. These programs are generally identified by an informal planning group made up of Rabbi Rosenbaum, Dr. Sarah Keller, and myself. In the case of this program, Audrey Siegel, Bikur Halim Rita Washington, the executive director, identified the need several months ago. The first person to agree to speak was Judy, who went on to recruit and everybody else, Eileen France, Elizabeth Stark. A few words now about our speakers, followed by Audrey, who spoke first. So we'll move that comment out. After our presentation, it'll be time for Q&As. Our speakers have also agreed to stay around after the program, and some of you have some additional questions. Rabbi Rosenbaum has served in the Greater Washington Rabbinate since 2000, 18 years. First as a rabbi of congregation Am HaTorah in Bethesda and since 2005 in Young Ezra Shom Emunah, Greater Washington. He became a rabbi of this shul in 2010. He's a musmach, he's a smich in other words, of the yeshiva Greater Washington and was a close Talmud of Harav Gedalia Enmer Zichron Livracha, serving as assistant rabbi for almost 5 years. Originally from Chicago, Eileen France has lived in Camp Mill for 22 years. She and her husband have two sons and a daughter, ages 23, 20, and 17. Eileen is a digital communications professional who works for a federal agency. As a member of a BRCA 1 family, Eileen has experienced firsthand the impact of hereditary breast cancer on patients and their families. Ms. Elizabeth Stark is a licensed and certified genetic counselor who specializes in hereditary cancer risk. She works primarily with families impacted by breast and ovarian cancer, incorporating genetic testing results with personal and family histories to help individuals achieve and maintain the highest level of health possible. She's a founding genetic counselor of the George Washington Cancer Center and also works as a consultant for Color Genomics. Her research interests focus on addressing access to genetic testing all through alternative delivery models and community-based participatory research programs. Judy Rosenthal is associate publisher of the Beacon newspapers. She's lived in Kempion for more than 20 years. She served on the board of the Bikur Halim of Greater Washington. 7 years ago, she underwent treatment for breast cancer. We'll turn the floor now to Rabbi Rosenthal.
This very packed, very important program ahead, so just really a few short minutes. First of all, I want to thank all of our presenters. I had the great honor to sit at a meeting with them the other night, and I'm sure you'll agree with me, it's a wonderful program that you'll hear today. I especially want to thank those who share some of their personal experiences. It's always a challenge. Thank you very much for doing so. Of course, a tremendous thank you to Max Rudman for all of his constant efforts. And of course, a tremendous thank you to Audrey Siegel and Peter Holland. If I could just add one more thing humbly to what Audrey was saying about the breakfast, as a person who attends many events in the Washington area over the course of the year, I think the Peter Holland breakfast is the greatest opportunity to see a very broad range of our Jewish community, and people frequently comment on it. So if people have not had the opportunity to attend before, it's besides supporting a wonderful organization, it's a unique opportunity to actually see people from the other end of town that many of us appreciate very much. This issue that we're gathered to hear about this morning really touches on a fascinating thing. On the one hand, we're people of faith. We believe very much that God puts us in situations that we can handle, and God has a plan, and God gives us tools. And then on the other hand, we're talking about a medical, technological advance. Maybe this is playing God. Maybe it's not our business. Maybe we should just, if the doctor tells us that we have a problem, we address it. And other than that, it's not for us to be smarter than that. So I would humbly like to strongly disagree with that view. God gives us numerous tools, and in his abundant kindness, God gives us a new opportunity in our times to act in a more proactive manner. And I would, on a religious level, I would say that to whatever extent it's medically responsible and significant to get oneself tested to understand if a person has certain genetic issues individually within one's family, it's incumbent upon us to do so. It's not okay to do so. It's essential to do so. This is yet another tool God is giving us to, God willing, live more fruitful and healthy and active lives and do all the wonderful things that he wants us to do in this world. It's one statement. It's good to know, as I'm sure you'll pick up on the discussion today, there are, medically speaking, there are great nuances in terms of appropriate treatments based on the situation. It's certainly true halachically also. There are definitely halachic questions that come up with some of these treatments. Obviously, some of these treatments would involve taking away one's ability to have children in the future. There are other halachic issues too. But just as medically it would be important to get specific guidance for one specific situation, same would be true halachically. And there could be numerous situations based on the facts on the ground or person's specific circumstances that things that we might normally think of as being halachically problematic would be halachically incumbent upon a person. So the same way that I'm sure you'll hear many times today, it's important to speak with your doctor about this or your genetic counselor about this. It's certainly important to speak with the rabbi about this. The third comment I want to make was really something that came to me from our meeting the other night. We have a way and a habit of looking at things in a very black and white type of manner. Something is good, what's the phrase we use all the time, is this good for the Jews or bad for the Jews, right? Something is good or bad. And obviously, as we know in many aspects of our lives, there's a lot of gray with things. As you'll find out today, if you're not already aware, Raqqa is nuanced, and the severity of how one's life is impacted by Raqqa can be nuanced. And this is a very powerful lesson both for Raqqa and for so many other things. When we hear something about ourselves or our family members, we should understand the nuance and the detail, and it's also true when we hear it about other people. If we hear, just forgive me for even giving the example, but I think it's important to share every now and then. Let's say a person hears about a potential life partner, and they're wonderful in all kinds of ways, but they have the Raqqa gene mutation. If a person's reaction to that and many, many other things is, the moment I hear that, forget it. It's a very unsophisticated approach to life. And again, we'll certainly hear about it today that it's nuanced. We certainly believe in finding out about situations, and far be it for me to say what possibilities people should pursue and what possibilities they shouldn't pursue, but we should understand that things are far more gray in life than black and white. I just think it's a worthwhile thing to think about. Thank you very much. Thank you for coming again. Thank you to our presenters.
Hi, good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for the invitation to come and speak with you. My name is Liz. I'm a genetic counselor, and I meet with people who have a personal or family history of cancer to talk about options, to talk about information, where things are at today, and to really try and give people a sense of what's ahead of them and talk about, you know, people as whole human beings. I think a lot of times, you know, I come from a family that has quite a bit of cancer myself, and I think a lot of times when you hear the word cancer, it's easy to shut off, and it's easy to say, oh, you know what, that's not something that I want to pursue any further. I think I shared with the group when I went to school to study genetic counseling, I said I would do anything except for cancer, until I learned that genetic counseling in the context that it exists today is much more about prevention than anything else. And I think if there's anything, any message that I get across to the group today, I hope you remember that having a BRCA mutation or having a family history of cancer is not a diagnosis of cancer. It's not any sort of guarantee that someone is definitely going to get cancer, but there are tools at our disposal to really move into the prevention space and to help generations look different than they have previously. What I want to go over, we kind of talked as a group, but I'm going to split my part up into two. The first part being a little bit more factual, a little bit of the basis of genes and heredity, and kind of set the stage for what the other members are going to be speaking about. And I think probably the first thing that people are really surprised to learn about is that the vast majority of cancer has nothing to do with family history. Only about 15% of people who are diagnosed with cancer have a diagnosis due to a genetic change or a genetic mutation that's in their DNA. And so most cancer we think of honestly as a disease of aging. The more times your cells divide, the more opportunity there is for a mistake to happen and for a cell to divide out of control. Genes are just little pieces of DNA that make a protein that protects you from cancer. So our whole body is made up of billions and billions of cells, and they divide all of the time. That's how you grow. That's how you repair tissue. That's a really important thing. You're not alive if your cells aren't dividing. You want your cells dividing. But then when cancer is just one cell that divides out of control. So inside of our cells, we have our DNA. A little piece of DNA is called a gene, and BRCA or BRCA is a tumor suppressor gene. It's really important, and every single person in here has two copies of BRCA. They got one from their mom and one from their dad, and that gene is protecting you from cancer. So it's making a little protein that fixes mistakes and makes sure the cells divide when they should, but not too often. So when we talk about someone having a BRCA mutation, what we're saying is that they have one copy of BRCA that's working, that's doing that job, that's protecting you from cancer. But the backup copy isn't. The backup copy has a change where it's no longer able to protect you from cancer. So if someone says, I have the BRCA gene, you'd be like, me too, we've all got two copies. But we're really trying to figure out is, are your BRCA genes protecting you from cancer the way we would expect them to? So if we think about a mom and a dad, you know, BRCA or BRCA is passed down, and it's called dominant. So if someone has a mutation or a change, they've got one working copy and one broken copy. And every time they have a child, they're going to pass on one of those two copies. There is no choice in the matter. We don't get to say, I think I'm going to pass on my working copy. You know, just like your parents didn't choose which copies of genes to pass on to you. It's like a flip of a coin, 50-50. Every person has 7 to 10 mutations in something. It's not just BRCA. We all have increased risks based on some sort of mutation. And so when we're talking about BRCA testing, what we're saying is we may be able to figure out what one of yours is and then do a better job taking care of you and then let you know ahead of time. I had the pleasure of being at a conference with Dr. Mary Claire King, who actually discovered BRCA 1 and 2. And she said to our entire group, every woman who finds out that she is a BRCA carrier after a diagnosis of cancer is a missed opportunity. Those are a missed opportunity for prevention, where we can talk about lifestyle. We can talk about a number of different things that can really change what the outcomes look like. Not only are there diet and exercise things that are very important and have been shown to have a big reduction in cancer risk, you know, for some women, there are medications you can take that can reduce risk. You know, for some women, considering surgery becomes part of the conversation. And so I think it's just really important to know that this information has been in all of our bodies from the day we were born. It's not changing. It's not coming or going. finding out about your genetic makeup does not change who you are when you walk in the door. But what it does is it lets your doctors do a better job taking care of you. This is an era that we are calling personalized medicine, which means we can look at your DNA and, again, tailor our recommendations for you based on that information. There are some people who will benefit much more from specific treatments than others. And so we really want to make sure we're getting the right information to the right people so that they can figure out, you know, what's best for you. Every time I sit down and I meet with a young woman, we have to have a conversation that you are more than the sum of your body parts. You are an entire person, and so it's important to surround yourself with providers and doctors that take that into consideration, that know that you are more than just a breast or an ovary. You know, you are a person who has desires, who has a family and a community, and that information can all be used together to help come up with kind of the best idea and the best treatment plan for you, which is probably not going to look exactly the same as your neighbor or your cousin or even your sister. When we think again about how most cancer develops, so this is what we call the two-hit hypothesis. You start out with two working copies of your BRCA or other genes that are linked with an increased cancer, and then something happens to one and it breaks. And that's not such a big deal because you only need one working copy. But then over more time, something happens to the other copy, and now there's nothing protecting that cell, and that's when a tumor can develop. So again, we're saying for people who are born with one BRCA mutation, they've only got one working copy. And that, for some women, that's good enough their entire lifetime. Having a BRCA mutation is not a diagnosis of cancer. And it's not a guarantee someone is definitely going to get cancer, but the rates are higher, and so the interventions we have available are different. Now, there are some certain flags that we recommend people think about when thinking about their own histories. And as Max mentioned, we know that in the general population, the rates of having a BRCA mutation are about 1 in 400, and it's 1 in 40 in the Ashkenazi Jewish population, and that's because of something that we call a founder mutation. Many, 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 many generations back, a mutation developed, and it propagated through the generations. That is true of every single ethnic group for different mutations. So there's no ethnic group around that doesn't have something specific to them that they just need to be a little bit more cognizant of and talking to their doctors about a little bit more often. So the red flags that we look for are any first or second degree. So that's sisters, moms, aunts, grandmothers, nieces, anyone with ovarian cancer is something that we want to make sure we're taking seriously. Another one for BRCA is breast cancer under the age of 45, any young breast cancers. If there is more than one breast cancer in the same woman, so not a recurrence, but a brand new second primary breast cancer. If there are multiple people in the same family with breast cancer, so if there are two or three relatives with breast or ovarian cancer. Again, multiple generations, so mom, daughter, and then also making sure that we're looking at dad's side of the family too. Because like I mentioned before, we get one copy from mom and one copy from dad. And just because dad doesn't have ovaries and very little breast tissue doesn't mean that risk couldn't be coming from his side as well. I put in a couple of examples of different family trees. They're pretty small, but just to kind of highlight a couple of different things. So the family trees, are these guys right here, men are squares, women are circles, and it shows the different generations. And so if someone is connected by a bar that goes up and across, that's a sibling. A line straight down is a child. And a line that connects two people is a marriage. And so in the first family history, we shade in the boxes for people who have cancer. So in the very first family history, you can see that in the entire four-generation pedigree, there is only one person who has cancer. And it happens to be a grandfather with male breast cancer, which we do see an increased risk of. There's no one else in that family who had been diagnosed until we got to the 35-year-old granddaughter. Having a BRCA mutation is not a diagnosis of cancer. And when we look at this family in particular, we see that man who had male breast cancer had two sons. And they were never diagnosed with cancer because their risks are lower. And so it's important to ask questions about previous generations and to really make sure that we know what's going on in our families. You know, there is some talk in the genetics community about if every woman at 30 should think about this testing, because the implication is so important. Now, that's not widely and routinely being done. I think it's still in the conversation phase, but it's this question of, is there something we can do to better take care of you, to hopefully try and prevent cancer? Is that something that you would want to know about? And I think it's a personal decision that we encourage people to have with their families, but something that we're starting to see more and more. In the second family, you can see a little bit more of a traditional cancer family. And so there, I saw a 25-year-old male who came in knowing his family history. His paternal aunt, so his father's sister, had had ovarian cancer. His paternal grandmother had had bilateral breast cancer, so cancer in both breasts at the age of 50. And he knew that this information would change things for him when he got a little bit older. And so that's a piece of information that he was looking for when he came in to talk to me, but a little bit more of a traditional BRCA looking family. The last one I put in, again, I saw a 34-year-old daughter, so she's in the yellow square. She has a 22-year-old sister. They're both healthy, unaffected. Her mom is 65, has never been diagnosed with cancer. Her mom happened to have a hysterectomy for other medical reasons. She needed to have that earlier on in life. And so we know that that reduces her risk of developing cancer, totally unrelated to knowing about BRCA. But it was her mom who had both breast and ovarian cancer. So by the time we get down to this, you know, the third generation, their mom is 65. They were honestly a little bit surprised because, again, their mom was healthy. She had never been diagnosed with cancer. But there were other questions that they didn't know they should be asking when thinking about kind of what that looks like. For genetic testing, there are many, many, many different options. Now, under the Affordable Care Act, for someone who is Ashkenazi Jewish who has a first or second degree relative with breast or ovarian cancer, and they have not had cancer themselves, there is no cost sharing if you have insurance, which means the testing would be absolutely free. This testing used to be very, very expensive, and that is no longer the case. It's actually has become much, much, much more affordable. The vast majority of women I see have no out-of-pocket cost whatsoever for this testing if we're using insurance. And the insurance coverage, again, is very good. There are also resources out there for women who do not have insurance. And so we don't want that to be a reason. There are good community resources that we can point women to help get the coverage testing if we feel like it's necessary. And so it's just important to have the conversation with your doctor if this is something that you're trying to learn a little bit more about. One of the ways that genetic testing has changed is that outside of BRCA, we have started to look at other genes as well, genes associated with an increased risk of colon cancer, for example. There is one small change in a gene that we see that we call a moderate risk. So BRCA comes with some pretty high risks of developing cancer if you're a woman. There's up to an 85% chance of developing breast cancer for a BRCA one mutation carrier who's a woman, up to a 40% chance of being diagnosed with ovarian cancer. And so we call that high risk. There are certainly things we would recommend people think about when addressing risks that are that high. There are other genes that are moderate risk. They're just a little bit raised. So sometimes we'll say, you know what, maybe you should start your imaging just a little bit earlier. Maybe we should consider a different technology that's going to be a better match for you when we're doing your imaging. Mammogram is not the right tool for every woman. Sometimes an MRI is a better tool. Sometimes we use ultrasound in addition to mammogram for a specific woman. So sometimes there are small changes we can make even about the type of technology that we're using. And so for the moderate increased risk genes, sometimes it's like, you know, instead of getting a colonoscopy at 50, why don't you get one at 40 and go every 5 years versus every 10 years? Sometimes it's very small changes that we're recommending. Now, medically, again, we do, if someone has a BRCA mutation, for the women who have BRCA mutations, when they're done having children, we do recommend they consider having their ovaries and fallopian tubes removed because we're not good at detecting ovarian cancer at this point. We are very good at catching and treating breast cancer if we're looking for it. You know, nobody wants to be diagnosed, but if we are looking for it and doing our routine imaging, we have every confidence that a woman's going to go on to live a long, happy, healthy life. Ovarian cancer is different. That's what's changing life expectancy. And so that's where the recommendation for what's called an oophorectomy, having the ovaries removed, comes from. Some women do choose, who have a BRCA mutation, to do a mastectomy to have their breasts removed prophylactically, but that is not the only option. There are plenty of women who choose to do high-risk surveillance, which just means coming in every 6 months, and to not have their breasts removed prophylactically. One of the things we talk about, again, I think for 10 different women, there are 10 different right answers. And so it's important to really explore all of the available options and all of the available resources when talking about medical risk and kind of next steps from that perspective. And the last thing I wanted to mention, so that just because your results are negative, again, that doesn't always mean that you don't have an increased risk. There's a tool that we use that takes into consideration personal and family history along with genetic test results to come up with a more tailored and personalized risk score for an individual. So, for example, having a child after the age of 30 raises risk for breast cancer as opposed to having a child before the age of 30. That's one small thing that we can add into that calculation in addition to the family history and the age a woman has her first period and her height and weight. All of these are personal factors that we can use to tailor that information about breast cancer risk. The Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act means that your health insurance can't use this information against you. They cannot raise your rates. They cannot drop your coverage. They can't tell you that you can't have access to services. What's not covered under this law is life insurance and disability insurance. So we sometimes talk to people about kind of where they're at in their lives, if that's something they're worried about. But we're not seeing anyone discriminated today. It's just it's not covered under GINA, that federal law, the same way health insurance is. Your health insurance absolutely cannot kick you off your plan if you do BRCA testing. And then lastly, just some common misconceptions that I hear a lot. Number one being that paternal family history of cancer doesn't matter. It absolutely does. These mutations, again, are inherited from both mom and dad in equal proportions. That there's nothing to do but wait and see. There are steps. There are technologies. The best treatment for breast cancer is early detection. The earlier we're looking, the more specifically we're looking, the better the outcomes are going to be. That testing is expensive. Again, most people don't have any out-of-pocket cost for testing and that you can lose your health insurance, which just isn't true under today's federal laws. The last website is just a place you can go to find a genetic counselor near you if that's something you're looking for. And now I'd like to turn it over.
I took this one. Okay. So as I was a child growing up in the 70s, my sister and I were both very aware that there was a lot of cancer in our family in general, and in particular, a lot of breast cancer. My father's sister died very young, at the age of 35, from breast cancer, leaving behind my two cousins, who were very young to grow up, without their mother. And then my father came from a generation where he was actually the only male in that generation. So all, he had his sister, and then all of his first cousins were female. And as we were growing up, it seemed like one after the next was being diagnosed with breast cancer. And in those days, in the 70s, they were not surviving it. So, you know, we have this whole generation of the cousins, you know, from my generation, I guess it's probably third cousins, who grew up without their mothers. And I will say that I remember from growing up, when I, the family gatherings that I remember most clearly are Shivas, not family holidays, because it was just happening so much. And because of this family history, I kind of grew up feeling like it was inevitable. Sort of as a, you know, as I became an adult, I was always sort of, there was a piece of me that was just always waiting for the day when I would find out that I had breast cancer, because it was so prevalent in our family. And then, you know, some of those cousins who were the daughters of my father's cousins who had breast cancer began to be diagnosed. And because we were aware of how much cancer, in particular breast cancer, there was in my family, my sister and I, every time we saw a new doctor, primary care, OBGYN, and we were asked about our family history, we would tell them about this. And I was told over and over, I was not told what Elizabeth just said, that it is a first or second degree relative that raises your risk. I was told every time that I did not have any first-degree relatives, you know, a mother or a sister with breast cancer, and therefore I didn't need to worry about it. It wasn't an increased risk. My sister was told the same thing over and over again, and in fact, she was even told that because the cancer was in my father's side of the family, it didn't count. It didn't matter. It wasn't a risk. So we, you know, both of us over time accepted what we were being told by the medical professionals. And then it was 6 years ago, it was November of 2012, that my sister called me and said she had just had a biopsy. She was waiting for the results. She had been going for all of her regular mammograms. She had had a clean mammogram within the last year, which I think less than 9 months, and she had noticed something in one of her breasts, and that she was, you know, very nervously waiting for results. And, you know, we had a very difficult weekend where we were waiting to hear, and indeed, she was diagnosed with a very aggressive breast cancer. And at that point, the doctor she was seeing then, the oncologist, I'm not sure if there's an oncologist here, whatever, whoever was doing this testing with her, at that point said, well, you know, you're an Ashkenazi Jew, so maybe, you know, you should get some genetic testing. So had anybody, this is what kills me, had anybody listened in all of those years when the two of us were telling them about all the breast cancer in our family, if we had been taken seriously at that point, I will always wonder if her cancer could have been prevented. But she and my mother, she doesn't live here locally, and she and my mother went to see a genetic counselor where she lived, and they took a family history and did a family tree, very much like the ones that Elizabeth showed you. And even before getting the testing results, just by looking at that family tree, it was so obvious that this was a genetic mutation being handed down. You could just see, starting, you know, in the generations as far back as my mother could remember, because it was my father's side and my father was no longer alive. But it would be, you would just go straight down the line of a family tree, and there was a mother and her daughters, and if there was a son in the middle, you know, it might skip that generation, and then it would just come back, and it would go across the sisters and down the same way. So the genetic counselor said, you know, we need to wait for the actual results, but it's clear. This is an hereditary cancer, and indeed it was. My sister did have a BRCA1 mutation, and I was told that I also need to get tested. Now I have my first degree relative, and this being 6 years ago, the situation was a lot different than what Elizabeth describes. In those days, it was very expensive, even if you had insurance, and it wasn't easy to get genetic testing. There was, you know, you had to get referred, and it just was harder to do then. And I did get, I was tested, and when I went to the genetic counselor, you know, I brought with me the family tree that my sister's counselor had done, and she took a look at it, and we spent a lot of time talking about if I were to come back with positive results, what does that mean in terms of my own breast cancer risk and ovarian cancer risk in the future, and what would my options be if I came out positive? I feel like there's a perception, and certainly a perception I had going in, that your only option was double mastectomy and, oophorectomy. And she talked to me about what the other less aggressive possibilities would be. And so I had some time to think while waiting for the test results. She also talked to me about, you know, what does it mean if the result came back negative? And, you know, as Elizabeth said, she explained that that would not mean I was never going to get breast cancer, but it did mean that my risks of breast cancer would be about the same as anybody else in the general population, that sort of elevation from being having the BRCA1 mutation would not apply to me. So in waiting, in the period of time when I waited for the results, I remember being a couple of weeks. It was a hard time, and what I remember most is not being all that concerned for myself. I was in my late 40s already, and I had my kids, and I, you know, did not, of course, want to have a BRCA1 mutation, but where my real worry was in looking at my children, and my daughter particularly, and thinking about, have I potentially passed something on to them that is going to put their future health at risk? And that was a really big fear of mine, and it was really much more prominent in my mind than whatever was going to be the result for me. So the results eventually came back, and I was negative. I do not have a BRCA mutation, and in many ways, that was a tremendous relief. And mostly, you know, I could look at my children and think, you know, thank God, like this is, you know, for our line of the family tree, this is done now. It's not going to keep going down my line of the family tree. And that was a tremendous relief. And at the same time, my sister was undergoing chemotherapy. She had a very aggressive tumor. BRCA1 tumors tend to be more difficult in many ways than non-BRCA tumors often. They often do not have the kind of receptors that can be specifically targeted by chemotherapies. And so it is that they often don't have as good outcomes. My sister going in was told that they really didn't know that it was possible they'd be able to completely, you know, get rid of all of the cancer, that they might be able to get rid of some of it, but not get rid of it completely. And it was possible that she would have no response at all to the chemotherapy. So, you know, we're going through this chemo and then after the chemo surgeries with really feeling like it was two-thirds possible that this wasn't going to be completely done by the time she finished. And learning that I did not have this was in some ways kind of difficult, because it does raise all those questions about why is she going through this terrible experience and I've been spared? And, you know, all the questions, is this what, you know, is what God wants? Is this some sort of completely just random flip of the genetic coin, and she got unlucky and I got lucky. And I was a little surprised that even getting good news, how much I struggled for a while with the result. Until finally it was my sister, you know, when I was talking to her about this, who said to me, you know, it wouldn't make me feel any better if both of us had cancer. So, you know, that was kind of permission to start being a little bit more relieved. So, you know, to sort of conclude this, thank God she did have a full response to the chemotherapy. You know, 6 years since her diagnosis. And she has been, thank God, completely cancer-free since she finished her treatment. So that is a tremendous relief. And what, you know, as I sort of look back on those days, the lessons that I sort of take with me and the things I think about the most are, first of all, this is not related specifically to breast cancer family history, but how much you need to advocate for yourself with the medical community. We both knew that there was something not right in our family when it came to breast cancer. And yet, we accepted it time and time again when we were told it's not a first-degree relative or it's your father. And honestly, I didn't really understand that what the possibilities would have been had I been taken seriously. I didn't really know at that point that, oh, you could have genetic testing and then you could possibly, you know, take preventive measures. But I did know that I was being dismissed and that that did not feel right. And so I think, you know, and this comes to any sort of health issue, it really drove home to me how much I probably should have been pushing, both of us probably should have been pushing a little more to be taken seriously. And I also think a lot about how the world has changed since 6 years ago when I was doing this. And it's changed a lot. Two things happened while my sister was undergoing treatment for breast cancer. One is that Angelina Jolie printed, if you all remember, an op-ed piece revealing that she had a BRCA mutation and that she had decided to have a mastectomy, a oophorectomy, and that tremendously raised awareness of BRCA mutations and of hereditary breast cancer that just during the time, from the time my sister was diagnosed till the time she finished, when I would talk about this with people, the understanding had changed completely. The other is that it became much more possible to do your own genetic testing at home through like 23andMe and these kits. They've become very cheap. At the time that I was doing this, it would have been thousands and thousands of dollars and nobody was doing it by themselves at home. Now people are. And so I think a lot about what would I have done if I could have, if that had been the case then, would I have just, you know, ordered a kit online and done my own testing? And there's a piece of me that thinks, you know, I might have just because it was so easy, and that would have been a really terrible mistake. And so my own personal opinion is if this is an issue for you and your family, and if you are thinking about learning if you have a BRCA mutation or some other genetic mutation, don't do 23andMe. That the kind of advice and education and counseling that you get from a genetic counselor is so valuable in helping you to understand the risks you're facing, the risks and benefits of different approaches that you can take if you do have a positive result, and the support from a person that you would get as opposed to just sort of getting these results by yourself and not knowing what to make of them. I feel really pretty strongly, having undergone this, that these do-it-yourself home kits carry a lot of misunderstood risks for what it means to get a result without the kind of counseling you get from a genetic counselor. And then the last thing that I really see that has changed in the world is you know, in the 70s, when it was my father's generation facing breast cancer, not one of them survived. You know, I had a whole generation of cousins who grew up motherless because this really was a death sentence. And what I see now is with my sister and with the female cousins who were born from those mothers, it's been hard, but nobody's died yet. And the improvements and the progress that we made clearly in treating breast cancer and even these BRCA1 breast cancers that are somewhat difficult to treat is really pretty incredible. And I think that that's really the biggest note of hope that I take as I look at the family history, that thank God, you know, people are being treated for this successfully in a way that they weren't, you know, 40 years ago.
One of the things that really stands out to me about what you're just talking about is the importance of understanding the range of emotions. I think that it is so important for everyone to give themselves a little bit of grace and understand that there are so many different ways that you can feel when genetic testing results come back, and that it's normal, exactly what you're talking about, something we call survivor guilt. Why me? Why not my sister? Why is this going on? And just to give everyone needs to have a little bit of space, and the importance of talking that through with your family members. If you're thinking about going genetic testing, how do you want to hear my results? Do you want to hear right away? Should we meet up in person? Really trying to protect those family relationships, which are so important and just kind of the bond of the community. And then finally, the other thing that you're pointing to really is that this is a completely manageable adult onset condition, but it needs to be managed. Having a BRCA mutation is not a life sentence, but it's something that needs to be managed and addressed so that people can have those really good outcomes. So thank you so much for sharing that experience.
Okay. I see this time for... after the presentation, we'll have time for Q&A, so line up some of your Q&As, and also have a chance to have some private conversation if you need to, but then we'll end this meeting on the program for a
while. I just want to thank Vika Holland and particularly Max and Audrey for coming up with the concept of this program, and for inviting and convincing me to participate. I was diagnosed more than 7 years ago, and I had no family history of breast or ovarian cancer, but I did have frequent cysts and lumps in my breasts through my whole adult life, and it makes it very challenging to check yourself if you are always finding lumps and they come and they go, and my gynecologist over the years always took them seriously, and I always had an annual mammogram, and sometimes they would send me with a direction to, you know, particularly check out some particular lump, but they never amounted to anything for many, many years, and it got to the point that I got very blasé about it, and I sort of thought, this is ridiculous, it never turns out to be anything. So I'm here to tell you that it can be nothing for a long time, and then one day it can be something. And so this particular year, I had my usual checkup, and the doctor said, oh, there's a particular lump, and you have to get it checked out. And I remember I actually said to her that time, you know, look, I'm really busy, my father's sick, I have a lot of responsibilities. You and I both know this never turns out to be anything. And she said, no, you have to go and you have to get the particularly detailed mammogram to check this lump out. So I went and I had it. And this was a different experience from any other mammogram because usually the technician does the mammogram and you wait for them to say, okay, the pictures are good, you can leave. Or sometimes they would say, we didn't get a good picture, come back and we'll do another one. And then now they say it's fine, you can leave. This time, I'm sitting and waiting to be cleared to leave. And instead, they bring out a doctor. I didn't even know there was a doctor hiding back there at the mammogram place. They bring out a doctor, and the doctor says to me, "You need to see a surgeon." And I said, "Okay, what are you telling me?" And that's, she just kept repeating that same line, "You need to see a surgeon." She would not make any speculation or say anything about what she thought, but I understood that this was like a code for, we think this is cancer, and you've got to do something about it right away. So it was, you know, it's just as chilling as, or maybe even more chilling as being told, "We think this is cancer," because it was just this line she kept repeating, "You need to see a surgeon." So I was very, very frightened. I mean, even thinking about it, I'm shaking just to remember. But like I had in mind that day, I was going to get the mammogram, go to CVS, go to Magruder. So I thought, all right, you know, I'm a sane person. I got the mammogram. I have to do something about it, but I still am going to go to CVS and Magruder's. So I went to CVS, and you know how like sometimes in the at the end of the aisles, they have these like cardboard displays for one product or another? So I knocked over one of those displays just like walking around in CVS. I mean, I'm clumsy anyway, but I was definitely from nerves. And by the time I got to Magruder's, my cell phone was ringing, and it was my gynecologist, which they had called her, and she was calling me. And it like wasn't even after 5 o'clock yet. It was 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and I thought, if my gynecologist is calling me at 3 o'clock, this is really another sign that this is very serious. So she said, "I'm going to send you a list of surgeons that I recommend, and you should call them and set up an appointment to have a biopsy." In other words, to have a sample taken to actually look under a microscope and check if it's really cancer or not. So that's what I did. I always, when I choose doctors, I always try to get information to find out that I'm choosing really good doctors, and this was no different. I made sure that this surgeon was highly recommended, and so she did the biopsy, and it's kind of like what Eileen is saying. Every time, at every step, there's always this delay of a few days while you're waiting for the results to come back, and it's a very, very long few days. So it did turn out that it was invasive ductal carcinoma, which is a very scary name, but in this case, it means basically garden variety breast cancer, and it was stage 2A, and in this case, that just meant it's a pretty big lump. The surgeon was very reassuring that this is a common kind of breast cancer, and there are a lot of good treatments for it. And so the next step was to see a cancer specialist, that's an oncologist, and their job is to advise you on the whole treatment, not just the surgery part. So because I'm Ashkenazic, the oncologist said, you know, you should have this genetic testing, and it's going to be covered by insurance because now you have breast cancer and you're Ashkenazic. And at the time, it was like a $2,000 test. And it turned out that I did not have the mutation. And so also, that's another thing that I want to emphasize, as the other speakers did, that being BRCA negative does not mean that you're in the clear. Most Ashkenazic women who get breast cancer do not have this mutation. And so it doesn't mean that you can, you know, think that you're you have nothing to worry about, or you can relax about your surveillance. But because breast cancer is so common, and you know, many Jewish women get it, many women in the general population, there is so much data on treatments. There's so much collected experience, and they subdivide it into so many little exact subtypes. And which treatments work for which types, there is so much data. So as Eileen was saying, today is so much of a better time than ever in the past, because they can consult that data and figure out for your individual situation what is statistically the best treatment that's going to give you the best outcome. So I had all these tests done on my tumor, and it was found to be this, as I said, very common type, which is fed by the hormones estrogen and progesterone. And I had a scan of my whole body that showed that it was did not appear to have spread anywhere. So the advice was to have my breast removed and to have chemotherapy and then to have an additional therapy I'll mention in a moment, but that there was no rational reason to remove both of my breasts or to remove my ovaries. In my case, no reason other than any other person would remove any part of their body because it could one day potentially have cancer. So I got wonderful medical advice from the excellent doctors that I had chosen, and I got a lot of very wonderful practical advice from other women in our community who've also had breast cancer. But I do think you need to get your medical advice from the doctors and your practical advice from the patients. So I had the mastectomy, and there was no sign of any spread to my lymph nodes, which was excellent news. After I recovered from the surgery, then I had 4 rounds of chemotherapy, and the point of that is to sort of poison any rogue cancer cells that might be anywhere else in your body, because the chemo goes through your whole bloodstream. But the chemo did, of course, what chemo is famous for, which is it made me feel crummy and it made my hair fall out. But I got through that. And finally, when that was all done, then the doctors put me on pills that soak up any other of those hormones in my body so that hopefully there wouldn't be any hormones around to feed any remaining cancer cells that might be trying to pop up and proliferate. Now, other breast cancers tell me, and this is the reason I bring up the pills, other people tell me that they hate the fact that they even have to take a pill. And, you know, that it's medicine and they don't like to think of themselves as sick. But for me, I never skip or miss a pill because I know it's part of my treatment. This just like the chemo and just like the surgery, this is part of my treatment. And this is the single best thing that I can do to make sure it doesn't come back. So for me, it's a no-brainer. And it's, you know, I can swallow it even without water on a fast day. When I take that pill, I know I'm doing something good. And thank God I don't have to think about cancer all day long like I did in those first few weeks. But this is something I can do every day, and I think of it as a very positive thing that I do. So I also asked, I ended up consulting 3 different oncologists, and each one, before I chose the one I was going to stick with, each one I asked them, is there anything else I can personally do to keep this from coming back or to even prevent any future cancers? And they all said the same things, and I also took that advice totally seriously. Through the whole experience, I got amazing support from my husband, Stuart, and from all of my friends and the whole community, but especially from the other breast cancer survivors and as well from Beaker Colon, which does amazing things quietly throughout our whole community all the time that we don't even know about. Now, I know a lot of people who have cancer and breast cancer particularly don't tell anyone that they have it, and I understand they have reasons for that. For me, it was much better to be able to get the support from everyone, and especially from the other cancer survivors who had so much good advice for me. And I'm happy that other people know they can come to me, and I'm always happy to give people advice. And even people who are keeping their cancers quiet, I keep your secrets. Anybody can always feel comfortable to come to me. So my take-home message to everyone is, please don't stick your head in the sand. Do your self-examination. Get your checkups on time. It doesn't mean you have to make yourself crazy, but if your doctor agrees that there's something to be concerned about, follow it up, no matter how many other lumps that you might have had turned out to be nothing. Now, I know a lot of women just want to sort of avoid the whole subject for fear of being uncomfortable or for fear of finding something terrible, but there. Your odds are so much better the earlier you find out what your situation is, your risks, or if you actually have a cancer. It's always better to find out sooner, and there's so much we can do now. The treatment has never been better. And ignore it, then you're setting your own stage for a bad outcome. So I hope we can look forward to a world without cancer, but until then, I hope you'll take these thoughts to heart. Thank you.
Okay.
You did a wonderful job of dealing with breast cancer. I just want to say that in my family we had hereditary colon cancer. My husband's father died in the early 40s. Then my sister-in-law, they found actually uterine cancer because they took out fibroids. And then 2 years later they found colon cancer. And the appropriate genetic counselors, the testing is not much easier. It used to be a blood test, now it's just a saliva test. They really are supposed to get the colonoscopies like once a year. My husband had a hard time getting a doctor to do that. He went in for a year and a half, they found the colon cancer. And the treatment is to remove the whole colon. He has no bag, he just met these colon tests to the rectum. And we had all our children tested, one is positive. And she has to be in her 20s already getting the colonoscopies. And I think they have to also kind of do sonograms. And so we are grateful to the genetic testing. We're grateful to the genetic counselors who also help us.
No, I think that's such an important thing. Yeah, it sounds like something called Lynch syndrome, which is just a different gene. So much like BRCA is associated with breast and ovarian, Lynch syndrome is colon and uterine. And our approach now is to honestly just look at all the genes if there's a reason, because if there are changes we can make to hopefully prevent cancer and we order one gene or we order, 40, it's the same cost, insurance covers it or not. And so we're looking at this as more information as we're learning more and more about families. So thank you for sharing that.
Heather? Yes. I have a question. We've been emphasizing Ashkenaz. And in my personal situation, my children are from a Yemenite mother. And I was just wondering how, if anybody has any answer to that, how much my Ashkenazi background and how much the Yemenite background might have.
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah, so the question is, if the parents have different ethnic backgrounds, how does that impact the children? And so, the children can still have inherited a mutation from you, that 1 in 40 rate would still be applicable from your side. And from your wife's side, like, these mutations can be in every population. It's not something that is solely in the Ashkenazic community. And so, again, there are different mutations associated with different ethnic groups, and it's one of the reasons we're starting to take more broad approaches. And not only that, like, borders are changing. I mean, all of the time, there are questions about where families are coming from. And so it's one of the reasons we're really looking more broadly, because every ethnic group can have a chance of having a genetic change.
Can you explain the more this concept?
So when more broad, for a long time, we know that there are three specific mutations in BRCA 1 and 2 that account for 95% of the risk in an Ashkenazic individual. That being said, we don't want to miss that other 5%. So we're not just looking at those three specific changes. Now we're looking at the whole genes. And there are actually genes that have breast cancer risks that are even higher than BRCA. So we want to make sure we're not missing those genes. There are all sorts of things that can change medical management as far as the age of starting imaging, the type of imaging. And so we've started using broad panels to really try and use that information to best match up for each individual what screening tool they want. We don't want to be doing MRIs in 30-year-olds who we don't think have an increased risk, because that's too much intervention. That's going to lead down the path of biopsies and other things that that individual doesn't need. But if they've got the high risk of breast cancer, I want to make sure they do have access to those tools. So again, really trying to match up for each individual what is the right screening and the right tool for them.
Thanks, Nancy.
Okay, so first of all, thank you very much, all of you, for sharing. I think it's a tremendous blessing that in our community we have that we should know more about these things and be able to take, you know, our whatever we do. And I would like to emphasize that my husband Avi, who's a family rapper, 30 years ago, we came to the Kentville community because he did a genetics fellowship at NIH. And at the time, he found it very unfulfilling because he said there was really nothing that he could, as a doctor, do for people when they found it. So thank God, you know, as the rabbi was saying, God has given us more information and you are sharing it today because we can do more. Two questions. One, I think it was Liz, said that there's a higher risk if you have a child after the age of 30. Is that only if it's the first child after 30 or any child after
30? So that's the having a first child after age 30.
Yeah. And then I guess I need a little bit more emphasis on if you don't have a lot of these risk factors, you know, you know, or maybe you have one small one, you know. What would you recommend as just a good way to handle, you know, run of the mill, a person just has some risk, not like tremendous amount of risk, but some risk. What would you recommend?
I think yearly mammograms starting at age 40 is important for everyone because we're really talking about early detection is the best cure for breast cancer. Women starting at age 40. And I think it's really important to ask if you're getting a 3D mammogram, also called tomosynthesis. It is a much, much better test than the 2D mammogram. So I think it's important to ask about that and to make sure that, again, you're getting the right test. And then there are different rules in different states about whether women are told after their mammogram the density of their breasts. That's another really big risk factor. So looking at your report, it should tell you what does your breast density look like. And if you have extremely dense breast tissue, that looks white on a mammogram, but so does cancer. And so a mammogram may not always be the only best test for you. If you've got extremely dense breast tissue, you may need to have follow-up with an ultrasound. And so really talking to your doctor about that and making sure that you're getting the best match for your personal history.
I had two questions. The one I was originally going to ask, but now just in response to Justin. So I know we've probably all heard that there's actually different recommendations about what to get the first mammogram, and that in addition to that, there are concerns about false positives, and ultimately we actually lead into biopsies and complications based on some of that. We're talking in general, not people with high genetic risk. Mm-hmm. And also, even in reconsideration of some categories of what's called breast cancer being identified anymore as cancer, and the possibilities of the treatments have not been necessary. So I want to address that, given just to every woman to maybe consider having one before. Is that agree on the medical community?
You're right. There is a lot of controversy. The USPSTF, the United States Preventive Services Task Force, you know, all of the different, you know, cancer institutes, everyone is kind of putting forth their own recommendations. I think when we come back to the best treatment is early detection, it makes us nervous to get away from those numbers. There is some talk about DCIS, sometimes called stage zero breast cancer. Ductal carcinoma in situ. It's sometimes called stage zero breast cancer, of reclassifying that and wondering, do we need to be doing big surgeries? Can we manage that with tamoxifen and every 6-month management? I think that the data is still out, because we know some of those will turn into invasive cancers, in which case they could have been treated before. And I think it's a hard discussion, and I think it is, we don't want people to be overly concerned. So a false positive, sometimes to me that means they saw something and they wanted to look more closely. And hopefully that thing isn't cancer. But I think when you compare the anxiety of someone who's had a callback versus someone who missed their breast cancer for a year, it might just be working in the breast cancer space and seeing that every day, but I feel like I'm still pretty focused on survival, and it makes me nervous that we could be missing those early treatable breast cancers if they go too long.
Second question was
So for men with BRCA mutations, our number one recommendation is prostate cancer screening starting between ages 40 and 45. That's a PSA, which is a blood test and a digital rectal exam yearly, because we actually think if we tested most men at 100, most would have prostate cancer, and most of that is incredibly slow growing, not an issue, not ever going to become a problem. But BRCA-associated prostate cancer is more likely to metastasize, more likely to be aggressive, have a higher Gleason score of 7 or higher, more likely to be a big issue. And so that's a Gleason is a kind of a gauge of how aggressive a particular prostate cancer is. And so we think because they're more likely to be aggressive, we want to know about it earlier and just to be a little bit more mindful of that. For BRCA2 carriers who are men, we know there is an increased risk of breast cancer, but we know that that's probably around 6 to 7%, which you can think of as half the risk of every woman in this room who has no family history or BRCA mutation. And so really, we're not necessarily doing much other than wanting men to be aware of their bodies. If they feel a lump, don't be like, that's strange, but you know, talk with your doctor, bring it up. We actually see quite a bit of male breast cancer caught by dermatologists who are like, I have this weird thing, you know. So just, I think it's important to be mindful of our bodies. And again, trust your instincts, know yourself. If you experience anything that is unexplained, persistent, going on more than 2 weeks, not coming or going, have a team that's going to listen to you, advocate for yourself, and really make sure that you have people who are following up on what you're experiencing. So there are a number of different genes that can lead to an increased risk of colon cancer. The high risk one that was being mentioned earlier is something called Lynch syndrome. And those genes are MLH1, MSH2, MSH6, and PMS2. The name isn't as important, but they all come with different varying risks of colon, uterine, ovarian, and some other cancers. There's one specific change in APC that is more common in the Ashkenazi Jewish population. Some mutations in APC result in a very serious condition that is not common in the Ashkenazi Jewish population. So that's one you want to be careful Googling, because it's not associated with something called familial adenomatous polyposis, which is like tons and tons and tons of polyps. That's most mutations in APC. There is one mutation in APC that has a slightly increased risk of colon cancer. So again, we start colonoscopy at 40 and we go every 5 years versus like needing to have your colon out. They're just night and day different, even though they're changes on the same gene. APC is just a name of a gene, kind of like BRCA.
You said federal law doesn't protect against life insurance and disability insurance. So do you recommend that somebody just sign up for life insurance and disability insurance before they go see the doctor for the first time, just in case?
I think it depends on where you're at in your lifetime. If you're 90, maybe thinking about getting a life insurance policy isn't going to make much sense at that point. So I think it depends. If you are 25 and just starting your family and you were thinking about it anyways, maybe. We're not seeing anyone ask today. It's more this idea that I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know what they're going to be asking in 5 years.
More questions? Do we have any present source? Well, thank you very much. We have a suggestion for other programs, and we appreciate your attendance. You are part of the reason we're doing these programs. Keep coming. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you.
That was really nice. It's amazing how much work you guys put into this. This is really great.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
This was really kind.